I'm Bert Cohen. Welcome to the Bert Cohen Show. And we are all about money. These days, everybody's talking about the deficit and Barack Obama's new budget as presented to Congress. Well, I'm very pleased to have somebody with us today who knows the economy perhaps better than anybody else. I suppose that's arguable. James K. Galbraith is the author of 7 books, certainly, unquestionably, one of the nation's top economists. He's chair of the Government and Business Relations Department at the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. His most recent book is The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. In the early 80s, he served as executive director of the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress, and he holds a Ph.D. in economics from Yale, but we won't hold that against him. Upon entering the White House, President Obama found the nation mired in the worst recession since the Great Depression. And with his new stimulus package, it seems Keynesian economics were back. We'll talk about Obama's approach to the economy, deficit spending, the anti-Keynesians, and the long-term outlook for economic security and stability with Professor Galbraith. Again, thanks for being with us, Professor.
Good to be with you.
Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, my. We don't seem to have him. Hello.
Hello, I'm here.
Oh, you are there. Oh, very good. Well, there's a new budget that's just been introduced by President Obama. He sent a $3.8 trillion budget to Congress, calling for billions of dollars in new spending to combat persistently high unemployment and bolster a battered middle class. The budget projects a $5.8 trillion deficit spending over the next 5 years, and that's a 35% increase over what the administration projected a year ago. Now, the White House expects the annual gap between spending and revenue to approach a record $1.6 trillion this year. And Professor Galbraith, in your current article, you argue, in reality, we need big budget deficits. We need them now. Tell us more about that.
Well, the budget deficit comes about in large part because the economy is in such terrible shape. When the private sector financial system collapsed, which it did in late 2008, the unemployment went up, tax revenues went down, unemployment insurance went up, Social Security, disability, all the things that help actually to support people's incomes when they're no longer getting paid in the private sector. And that brings on the federal budget deficit. But it's absolutely essential to help stabilize people's income, stabilize their consumption, and keep the larger economy from going into an even deeper decline. If we had not had the big federal government sector that we have now, then, first of all, our states and localities would have gone bankrupt. They would have been cutting back even more sharply than they are. And unemployment would have gone much, much higher. We would be much closer to the Great Depression, where in March of 1933, the unemployment rate was 25%, than we would be to the 10% unemployment that we have today.
which of course isn't very good, but it could be a heck of a lot worse. It was worse in the 1930s. It was like 25%, something like that.
And, you know, and in those days, the federal government was something like 10% of the economy, rather than the 30 to 40% that it is, that the government is now.
So perhaps that was even more not outrageous, but strong, more bold back then, given that it was just 10%. And we've all seen in the past couple of weeks or so, there's public outrage over government spending. Obama's spending plan is designed to steer a middle course, as seems to be his style, between those two opposing goals, spending and outrage over the deficit. Is it accurate to say that there must be intense deficit spending to lower the unemployment rate before those deficits can come down?
There, I think, is no way, no practical means to get the unemployment rate down except through the federal budget. And that means big deficits, sure. Is the public outraged about government spending? There are certainly loud voices
yes.
in politics and in the media who have been pushing this particular line. I don't see it. I don't think the public gets outraged over abstractions. I think the public is rightly very anxious, very angry about the state of the economy. They would like to see improvements. And however those improvements arrive, they will rally behind them.
Yeah, I think you're right. The media loves drama, and politics is theater, really. And the drama right now has been with the loud voices screaming about the deficit. But there have basically always been budget deficits. And if you look at various polls and focus groups, people generally don't really care. It's not that high a priority, whereas restoring the middle class and bringing jobs back to the United States, I think, is something that people really do care about. It does seem that
The word deficit
yeah.
has a very negative connotation in people's minds. It just conveys the impression of something bad. Surplus conveys the impression of something good. Oh, that's a time that people think of perhaps in farming terms, plenty versus famine, feast and famine. But in the federal budget, these weighted terms are not really very helpful. The fact is that when the government does run a surplus, as it has done on a few occasions in our history, half a dozen or so, that tends to starve the private sector of funds because the government in a surplus is taking out from the economy more in taxes than government spending is putting in as income. And the effect of that is to suppress private economic activity and put the economy into a recession. Most recently, that happened in the late 1990s and resulted in the recession of 2000-2001.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with Professor James K. Galbraith about the economy, something you must be talking about a lot these days. You say that the economy works better when people are happier and can borrow and invest privately. How does the federal deficit play into this? What is the relationship between public deficits and private savings?
Well, the public sector and the private sector exist in a kind of reciprocal relationship, one to the other. If the public sector is in deficit, as it is now, the private sector is in a kind of financial surplus as a result. And that you can see this in the data on private savings, which have gone up dramatically in the slump. People are not taking on new debts. They're trying to pay down their old debts, and the private savings rate has gone up as a result. Correspondingly, when the private sector is in deficit, which is to say when the private sector is taking on lots of new loans, when it's borrowing against the equity in its houses, or when businesses are borrowing to expand, then there's a lot of income in the economy, there's a lot of tax revenue, and the public sector goes toward balance or surplus. And we saw that in the late 1990s. So these two things are, in fact, kind of mirror images of each other. And as I say, the reason we have the big deficits right now is that we don't have the functioning private credit sector. And it's clear that that's a cause of major anxiety because people basically are accustomed to, and quite rightly, to being able to finance economic activity, to finance employment and job creation from the banking sector, and they can't do that now.
And how is Obama's new budget going to help with that specifically by enabling smaller community lending institutions, not just the big banks that got helped by TARP, but helping the smaller banks get some capital? How is that going to work? And why should people have faith in that, or should they?
Well, there is some movement in the Obama banking plans, and particularly in the announcement of the Volcker Rule and other measures of the last few weeks, that will begin to realize that part of the problem of our banking system is that it's excessively dominated by a small number of very, very large institutions, which basically have the power to set policy for the entire economy.
Yeah.
And it would be much better to restrict the growth of those institutions and enable smaller institutions, community-based institutions, which were not involved in the subprime mortgage debacle,
right,
to grow into an expanding economy, and I think that some of the measures that were discussed, and the president has proposed, would tend to help smaller institutions at the expense of larger ones, and that's a step in the right direction.
And I wonder if people, just average people who are not, people who spend all their time looking at numbers and economic ratios, will they see the results of this? When do you think, how quickly do you think we'll actually see the results? That's one thing that's, I think, made a lot of Democrats who want to support the president a bit nervous, because there's a lot of spending and there's not a lot of creation of jobs. I mean, certainly the stimulus helped. Not everybody understands that. But how soon do you think, you know, making smaller banks able to get the capital, when will people start to see actual jobs created?
Well, the difficulty in the credit sector, just leaving aside this restructuring question, is with the borrowers. We had a vast credit expansion over the last several decades because American households were able to convert the equity in their homes into cash. And that helped fuel economic expansion. It was not sustainable. It was a process that was deeply abused by many financial institutions, which originated a lot of mortgages that they realized that their borrowers could never pay in full. And they took the fees and sold the mortgages upstream, and the whole house of cards collapsed in 2007, 2008. And when it did, home values fell, and I think it's up to a third now of American families are upside down in their mortgages. Their houses are not worth what they owe on their in mortgage debt. And the problem there is that that is not a situation that's easily fixed. It's not going to be fixed for as long as we have a large excess supply of housing and a lot of people facing foreclosure. It's a matter of the price of homes being sold between private parties, and it simply it takes a long time to work through the kind of excess inventory that exists. In Texas, 20 years ago, it took about 7 years to get through a similar problem on a much smaller scale.
Mm.
So I don't think we're looking at an early revival of private credit, leaving aside the fact that it will happen, you know, whatever happens will happen faster if smaller institutions take the lead. I don't think it's a realistic prospect for the near future. And that is why you have to go use the other tool that you have, which is the public sector. That is why you need to have a jobs program and an investment program of the kind the president announced in his State of the Union. And all of the focus, it seems to me, the practically hysterical talk about these big future deficits, it seems to me, serves to distract attention from the urgency of getting behind the president on this issue, getting a jobs bill drafted and through the Congress, and getting an investment program. And the president, I think, mentioned three major areas: transportation, energy, and education, where we could do a lot of work to improve the country, to put a lot of people at work for quite a long period of time. And I say that's where our economic focus and our political focus should be right now.
Again, Bert Cohen here. We're talking to Professor James K. Galbraith about the economy. Who's quoted in every newspaper and every media these days, so it seems. And the Republicans do seem to be, once again, living up to their portrayal as the party of no. The anti-Keynesians, and at some point we'll need to define John Maynard Keynes and his input on this and power over this, they look to the Federal Reserve to steer and stabilize the economy. But it seems like that hasn't really worked. They lowered interest rates. They lowered them all the way to zero. It didn't seem to be enough. And I wonder how different qualitatively or similar is Obama's fiscal policy from that of Bush, who we all recognize created. It didn't come out of nowhere, and it wasn't just Bush, but we've had a deficit for a long time when we've needed to address credit issues and the housing sector for quite some time. So I guess how wrong are the anti-Keynesians who say, oh, just let the private sector take care of it, it'll right itself?
Well, the Bush administration, I think, does bear a very heavy responsibility for what happened. It was that administration that desupervised private mortgage originations and that essentially let the subprime sector get out of hand. And they did that, I think, quite deliberately to foster a temporary growth in home building to curry political favor and to make their economic numbers look better.
Yeah.
So they bear a pretty heavy responsibility. Obama inherited a situation which was very different. He doesn't have the option of finding some easy way to foster or to give the illusion of economic growth via the private credit sector. The private credit sector has been really ripped to pieces. It is not acting and as it has over the last 30 years, and it won't come back to that kind of aggressive private credit expansion and for quite a long time. So there are people who believe that if you just drop the interest rate to zero, that borrowing would return. Turns out it's not so.
Right.
Why isn't it so? Well, private households, first of all, don't have any collateral against which they can borrow. And so they can't come in and say, give me a home equity loan. No, they haven't got any equity in their homes. Secondly, private households, and it's largely realized, as private households do in these situations, that they can defer purchases of new, especially durable goods. They can put off the purchase of a new car or new electronic equipment or other things that they would ordinarily buy because, generally speaking, they have an old car or an old television set which can be made to serve a little bit longer. And so you have a big delay in the orders for this new equipment. And you can, to some extent, you can deal with that by giving people incentives. Cash for Clunkers, for example, worked on that. But that's a major reason why private consumption is going to be quite slow for quite some time into the future. So that being so, then your options are narrow. And what the president proposes is that we take advantage of the resources that we have available, the unemployed labor, the unemployed technologies, the unemployed equipment, and that we put it to work on enterprises which are public or semi-public. We have a transportation network in this country. It's very decrepit,
yes,
and it's the wrong technology for the next century. It's vastly too dependent on fossil fuels. So we should get to work on rebuilding our transportation technology. The president specifically mentioned high-speed trains, which thousands of miles are being constructed right now in China. That's something which we have a big country. We could use a network of that kind. There are lots of other things that we could do that would be very effective at putting people to work and help solve some of our, of our longer-term problems, which are, I'm not talking about financial problems, I'm talking about the environment, I'm talking about climate change, things that we're going to have to face up to sooner or later.
It does seem to me, and I will acknowledge being a fan of the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt's, and I believe it was Rex Tugford who helped design quite a bit of that, and of course, John Maynard Keynes. It seems to me, just in simple terms that we can see here and now, there are a lot of people out of work. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, such as you say, building new high-speed rail, such as schools and bridges and our electric grid, and of course, safe, clean, renewable energy. And yet, at the same time, I sense a real reluctance on the part of the Obama administration to go full tilt toward a New Deal kind of approach, to have the government as employer of last resort.
Since you mentioned that phrase, that there's work to do and there's people to do it, I can't resist reading to you. I just grabbed this off the table from something that came out a little bit before the New Deal. It's John Maynard Keynes' tract in favor of the Liberal Party in Britain in the 1929 election, and it talks about the resistance to doing the sensible things. He says, there is work to do. There are men to do it. Why not bring them together? No, says Mr. Baldwin. Baldwin was the conservative prime minister. There are mysterious, unintelligible reasons of high finance and economic theory why this is impossible. It would be most rash. It would probably ruin the country. Abra would rise, cadabra would fall.
Herbert Hoover said similar things, I believe.
Yes, I mean, it's a standard reaction, and we're hearing it now from people, by the way, who never warned about the credit crisis, who never warned about the banking crash,
right,
who sat in their palaces on Wall Street prattling on about Social Security and Medicare while their own home precincts were being completely run to ruin, and who now come out to tell us, to lecture us on budget deficits, a subject about which, frankly, they know nothing and understand nothing.
Yes. It does seem to be the case. And I notice, you hear the leading Republicans howling about the deficit, but where were they?
I have to say, bipartisan interjection here, this is not just a Republican problem. Well, and in fact, when the Republicans are in power, they sing a quite different tune. Ronald Reagan never worried about budget deficits. George W. Bush didn't worry about them, and Dick Cheney was famously quoted as saying, Reagan taught us that budget deficits didn't matter. So when the Republicans are in power, they take a very different line than they're taking now. The unfortunately consistent political leaders in this area are the Democrats, who glommed onto this issue way back in the 1980s because they thought it was a useful way to embarrass President Reagan, and have been stuck on it ever since. And that's very hard to make for a functional government when a very large part of your political leadership finds it just irresistible to play to this particular crowd with this particular set of talking points.
Posturing. Peacocking, whatever you want to call it.
Paul Krugman drew a distinction between the true deficit hawks and the deficit peacocks.
Yes.
He favors the hawks over the peacocks, but I'm the other way around. I prefer the peacocks precisely because they're not sincere.
Good point.
And sincerity is not something that's useful here. It just gets in the way and endangers programs which are really fundamental to the well-being of the American public, Social Security and Medicare.
Oh, yeah.
So on the whole, if I had to choose between an insincere peacock and a completely committed, ideologically determined hawk, I'll take the peacock every time.
Good point. They can do less damage.
Exactly.
And for years, we've heard the phrase from, people on the right in general, why can't government run more like a business? Well, I always come back and say, hey, look at any successful business you know. You got to invest prudently if you want a prosperous future. I don't know why they don't see that principle works for government as well. If we don't invest now, I mean, what would this country look like now if Obama didn't have his, you know, perhaps middle course stimulus? We have to invest. I don't know why they can't get that. That's just a part of a successful business.
I think that's entirely right. And when the private sector is not investing, the public sector should. Obviously, we like having a vibrant private sector.
Yes.
And so there are moments when you want I think the late 1990s were a useful example of this, when the private sector is doing so many interesting and useful things that the public sector doesn't need to be in the lead. But this is not such a moment. Well, another side, though, of the same questions, it would not be one of the most misleading things about this discussion is the claim that the government is just like a household, and just as your household has to balance its checkbook, the government needs to balance its budget. The metaphors are entirely misleading, first of all, because many households do, in fact, carry a substantial debt.
It's called a mortgage, yes.
And carry their mortgages over a long period of time,
Absolutely.
Other debts as well.
Yep.
And that's perfectly reasonable economic behavior.
Of course.
But the main difference is that ultimately a private household does have to earn income in order to service its debts. And the government, since the early 1790s, virtually never does that. It doesn't have to do it, and it doesn't do it. It almost always is spending more than it takes in taxes. So we've been running deficits and increasing the national debt for the entire lifetime of the Republic, and it would be useful if people notice that this is sort of the normal condition. In the last 30 years, just to add to that, in the last 30 years, there's been a new element, which is that the dollar has become the currency of preference for most of the rest of the world that wishes to hold reserves. And as a result of that, we've had to run even bigger deficits to make sure that the rest of the world has the treasury securities that it wishes to hold, which is a good thing from our point of view. It's enabled us to import more and export less and to live at a higher standard than we otherwise would have. But at the end of the day, there is no reason to expect, and in fact, it would be quite catastrophic to attempt to move the government back toward a situation in which it was trying to tax as much as it spent.
Yeah, that would be not a pretty picture. Again, Bert Cohen here. We're talking with Professor James K. Galbraith about economics. And I wonder about, in terms of borrowing, have there been adverse effects of deficit spending on rates of interest that the public sector must pay? And part of that, how does deficit spending public spending affect American credit with nations abroad? How does that affect us in the long term? What might it affect our leadership and our standing in the world?
Well, it's a very interesting question. It's a question raised by David Sanger's article on the front page of the New York Times right now. Today. The question that was posed there was, what should we fear from these projections of rising budget deficits as a share of GDP 8, 9, 10 years from now, toward the end of the 2010s? One way to look at that question is to ask, the federal government can and does borrow at terms up to 20 years, a 20-year treasury bond, mm-hmm. which, if issued today, would have to be still being serviced. It wouldn't be retired until 2030. So that 2020 date is only halfway through the lifetime of bonds that are being issued today. If the people who lend to the U.S. government were deeply alarmed,
right.
As deeply alarmed as, say, Larry Summers is by these budget numbers, they would have a way of protecting themselves. They could demand a higher interest rate. So one can open up the paper and ask, what is the interest rate on the 20-year Treasury bond? The answer is it's a bit under 4.4% as of a few days ago. That is substantially lower, in fact, than the that same interest rate was 10 years ago when the federal budget was in surplus. So there's just no evidence that the credit markets are in any way concerned about the reliability of the United States government as a borrower. Quite the contrary. There's every evidence that people around the world would like to lend to the U.S. government just as much as the U.S. government wishes to make use of.
Yeah.
And they have good reasons for doing that. The dollar is the currency of a large and stable country, and there are no really good substitutes for as a reserve that can be used effectively to finance international trade for other purposes that countries wish to hold reserves.
Again, Bert Cohen here. We're talking with Professor James Galbraith about the economy. And we've touched a few times on the name John Maynard Keynes. Now, not everybody has heard of John Maynard Keynes, but he is unquestionably one of the most important figures in the entire history of economics. He really revolutionized economics with his book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, back in 1936. Many would argue that Keynes' 73-year-old theory is now being tested for the first time. I kind of thought it was tested in the 30s.
It was tested in the 30s, and it was tested even more in the 1940s in the mobilization for World War II. So we've had a lot of experience with Keynesian economics, and Keynesian economics was for a time a fairly broadly accepted economic policy doctrine in the United States in the middle 1960s. It ran into difficulties in the 1970s. Because it did not, it was not well prepared. It was not adequately prepared for the price shocks that came from oil, in particular, from the, and more broadly from the devaluation of the dollar in 1971 and the consequences of that. So, over the last generation, we've seen a vast forgetting of Keynes and who he was and what he wrote, but he's well worth rereading because a lot of what of the problems that faced the world in the wake of the crash of 1929 and the banking failures of the 1930s resemble the problems that we have now. And so when thinking about how you manage an economy when your private credit sector is not doing its normal job, Keynes's book is a very useful document.
Still applicable. I'm still waiting for a bumper sticker that says, bring back Keynes. I haven't seen one anywhere. But
well, there are quite a few people who have had that idea. And I have on my desk a stack of very interesting books recently published, which can make Keynes accessible to readers today.
Oh, that's good to know. Well, talking about the 1930s, a fascinating era in American history, one that I think a lot of people don't really, I mean, it's kind of forgotten. But the 1930s, one thing everybody knows is there was great economic misery throughout the entire nation and in Europe as well. And in Europe, that economic misery led, as we know, to fascism and Stalinist communism. And Keynes believed, if I have it correct, that intervention was necessary to keep economies away from economic disasters, which would often lay the groundwork for a Marxist or fascist approach. And I find it interesting how some people who are getting a lot of media attention claim that Obama is a socialist of some sort. Is Keynes not, his theories, the application of his theories, is it not necessary to avoid such, radicalism as fascism or communism?
Keynes was, in English terms, a member of the Liberal Party. He was not a member of the Labor Party, the trade union dominated party of that time. And he sought to preserve the, broadly speaking, the capitalist system.
Right.
He understood that in order to preserve it, you needed to have a stabilizing mechanism that had to be the government, and that government had to be dedicated to the goal of full employment. And full employment In fact, the influence of that idea has been so strong here in the United States that full employment is written into our laws. It is the statutory goal of economic policy, binding on the government at large as well as on the Federal Reserve, and has been in those terms since 1978. Achieving that goal, as Roosevelt understood, mm-hmm. requires that you have a competent government that's willing to do what's necessary.
Yeah,
and that's the issue to us today: is can our government do the job that it has to do when faced with a crisis of this kind? Mm. If it gets entirely wound up in, as I say, these notions of high finance that people mouthing them simply do not understand, and bogged down in the trench warfare of our politics, we will miss an opportunity. The great glory of the 1930s in the United States was that Franklin Roosevelt didn't miss his opportunity. He put the nation back to work, and actually the Great Depression was over in March of 1933, and the next 4 years showed some of the highest growth rates and most rapid employment gains of the ever recorded in peacetime.
Yes, and that brings me to another question. You often hear that, Roosevelt, his policies didn't work really to end the Depression. It was only World War II. But I wonder, it seems to me that FDR's implementation of such policies did, in fact, work to end the Depression. But then along came 1937. What was the effect that year when FDR was forced by a resistant Congress to rein in spending? What were the effects on our national recovery when that happened?
Yeah, well, first of all, you're completely right about the early New Deal period, 33 to through 36. The unemployment rate dropped to around 10% or a little bit below from 25%. So it's a huge reduction.
Yeah.
It's obscured in the historical data because economists neglected to count the people who were actually working for the New Deal. So if, for example, you were building the Chicago waterfront or the Triborough Bridge, you may have thought you were employed, but later statisticians decided that that was just temporary make work and didn't count you. In 1937, and I won't completely exonerate Roosevelt here, Roosevelt decided that he needed to throw a bone to the budget balancers.
Yes.
And there was something else going on as well, which was that the Social Security Act had been passed. Payroll taxes went into effect that year, but there were no benefits being paid. So in addition to the balance the budget movement on the regular account, there was this new account that was acting as a drag by taxing wages. The two things were sufficient to put the economy almost directly back into recession. Unemployment went back up to, I think, around 15%, and Roosevelt quickly reversed course. So by 1938, yeah. He was back into New Deal mode, and then the war came along and vast mobilization occurred, and by 1940, unemployment had disappeared.
So it was basically huge deficit spending.
Huge deficit spending. And 41 to 45, the deficit was 25% of GDP
wow.
each year.
Oh, my.
So that by the end of the war in 1946, the federal budget deficit, federal debt was over 120% of total product. So much, much higher in relation to total output than it is now. And then, well, people, you might say that would have caused a financial disaster. But it didn't. Interest rates did not rise. When the war ended, people went back to work in the civilian economy, and eventually those deficits went down as the civilian economy grew.
That's exactly how it's supposed to work, isn't it now?
Sure.
And I wonder to what degree is the Obama administration trusting the findings, the work of John Maynard Keynes? You know, you read about the people who are advising, sitting around the economic table with the president, people like Larry Summers, who, you know, he has been, and others have been in favor of dismantling regulatory barriers and controls, such as the Glass-Steagall Act, which limited what financial institutions could do. And now he's advising Obama. And I wonder how much of a factor was weakening such controls and causing the current crisis. And do you see Obama getting it, really, or is he too surrounded by people who may have had similar, you know, pro-Wall Street views as opposed to necessarily pro-Main Street, which may not be exactly opposite, but not necessarily the same? Is he getting it? Is Obama getting it? Do you think, is he on the right course now?
I see in the last few weeks encouraging signs of some change. I think in the first year of this administration, the president was persuaded by the Larry Summers, Timothy Geithner, Ben Bernanke, view that the most important thing was to preserve the banks, and they basically put their principal effort into that very successfully. Unfortunately, preserving the banks was not the same thing as producing a economic recovery. I see now with the new initiative centered on the proposals of Paul Volcker, clearly supported by Vice President Biden and by others in the administration, a tougher and more realistic attitude toward the large banks. And at the same time, I see in the budget and in the State of the Union a really clear statement of priorities. There was, I think, early on a kind of expectation, if you like, of false hope and optimism that the economy would rebound. And certainly last spring, there were a lot of business economists who were saying that. The State of the Union, it seems to me, made it very clear that the administration doesn't expect this to be over easily.
Yeah.
It sees the need for a major initiative on jobs, a major initiative on the larger public investment priorities. And I mentioned earlier transportation, green jobs and
energy
and education were mentioned specifically in the president's speech. That is a long-term project, and the recognition that that's where the priority should be seems to me to be a very important step. It's a signal to the Congress that they should get busy and start drafting the appropriate legislation for debate and enactment this coming year. And if we get that done, then maybe things will fall into place. But of course, if they don't, then you just have to keep at it until they do.
Yeah, indeed. The budget has its priorities in it. That's what budgets are, for the home as well as for the government. And it seems that defense spending is always off limits. No, you can't touch that, even though we spend, last time I checked, about $65 billion a year maintaining obsolete weapons. You can't touch it. The 2011 Obama budget calls for an additional $33 billion for the Defense Department. How does what I call military welfare affect our economic security? Is this rate of spending on the military sustainable, or does somebody have to have the backbone to take it on?
Well, I have for 14 or 15 years now been the chair of a small organization called Economists for Peace and Security, which is a professional group that's concerned with these issues. And I think that they are extremely important questions. One has to look at the defense budget in the context of our security requirements and ask, do we need, first of all, the commitments that we've made in Iraq, in Afghanistan? If we reduce those commitments, we can reduce the amount that we spend on supporting military activities there. If we don't reduce the commitments, then we have to support the troops. It goes without saying. There is another major area where one can look very critically at particular activities in the Defense Department. Procurement. Right? We have major problems with the structure of procurement in particularly advanced technologies, fighter aircraft. There is an ongoing struggle over the F-35. There has been one over the F-22 right. planes, which in the nature of these very advanced technology enterprises, get loaded with missions that they can't all perform effectively, that tend to compromise them as compromise their performance and inflate their cost, driving down the number of hours that the planes can actually fly, and therefore their actual utility as a real vehicle of Air Force power. These are issues which need to be dealt with basically one by one, and there's no doubt that if you did it in a very aggressive and professional way, and if you had the the political winds at your back, you could save a lot of resources in those areas.
The political winds at your back. One of the other great quotes from FDR was when he met with, I can't remember which civil rights leader, saying, "I'm on your side. I want to do it. Now make me do it." There has to be a public pressure for that. That is for sure. And I remember, you know, when the Vietnam War ended, we thought there was talk of a peace dividend. Well, spending on the military just continued. It seems to be untouchable. Bert Cohen.
Well, actually, I think that's not correct. And the Vietnam War ended in 75, and the military did, in fact, shrink as a share of GDP between 75 and 1980. That was reversed in the early years of the Reagan administration, which wanted a big buildup to basically to frighten the Soviet Union.
Yeah. Well, it just seemed to work, and a lot of people got very wealthy. And speaking of which, we've talked about the large financial institutions, and I know economics is a science, and there's also human nature. I wonder how much simple greed is a factor, such that in periods of economic stability, financial market participants want higher returns. There's greater risk. As you say, they make bets with greater leverage. Is it in the very nature of large lending institutions, if left unbridled, to in fact become predatory?
Oh, sure. But I wouldn't put this to greed. Greed is like gravity. It's always present. Yes. Whether the bridge falls down is not a question of whether you can control gravity, but whether you can build it in a sufficiently
thus the science,
way.
Yes.
Yeah, and so what we need here to understand that just that you have to have in the financial system skeptical, autonomous, and effective regulators who are looking at particular practices and saying to people, sorry, that's over the line, you can't do it. And in the early 1990s, in fact, in commercial real estate in the Southwest, the regulators intervened. They saw a dangerous bubble emerging in subprime mortgages, and they stopped it. The difference is that in the 2000s, they just let it go. And, of course, what happens then is that the sharp operators run away with the sector. They run away. Their companies do better. Their stock valuations go up, and they drive their more staid competitors who are actually conforming to sensible norms, conventional practice, proven practices, get driven basically out of the market. So you get very quickly a takeover of the sector by the most aggressive players.
So then, wouldn't that argue for a reinstatement of something like Glass-Steagall to have some real regulations on there? And I don't see any political will to make that happen. Do you?
Well, the Volcker Rule does move in that direction, and so I think. Well, the administration hasn't gone as far as I would like to see them go.
Right.
They have taken steps in the right direction to recognize that you do need to separate the risk-taking activities that are usually associated with investment banks from federally insured depositors' funds. Is giving a federal guarantee implicit to unbridled risk-taking as a formula for disaster.
Yeah, it does seem to be. Again, Bert Cohen here on The Bert Cohen Show. We're talking with Professor James Galbraith, noted economist, one of the nation's top for sure. Just to wrap it up a bit, kind of a general view here. Government spending, as we've seen, can certainly prime the pump, as Roosevelt said, of consumerism. But I wonder if the model of growth based on growth in consumption. Is it the best for long-term economic security? Is continued growth in consumption really the best model for the long term? Aren't there really limits to growth and expansion? How essential is the growth of consumption to economic security?
Well, consumption is and will remain the largest share of total activity. It's on the order of 70%. But the important thing for growth now is that we put the emphasis on the needs that we have to meet. And we have a country that, as I said earlier, basically we need to rebuild. Let's get started on that. We need to change the way we produce energy and the way we consume it so that as we think about consumption going forward, we need to integrate into our planning and into our way of life a sustainable energy model, mm-hmm. a way in which to live in which meets the challenges of the environment and climate change. That's a major enterprise. It involves conserving a lot of energy that we currently waste and using new forms of energy which aren't as dependent on fossil fuels. So there's a second sort of great activity. We have an elderly population which is going to need a lot more care than our population has needed in the past. So we need to work out ways for people to work in that area to provide the kind of care that people need. If we think through what our problems are and how we can provide for ourselves, I think we can do fine. But not again if we allow a kind of hysteria over financial numbers to get in the way of the actions that we need to take.
Question: is there the political will to do what's right, as you say, to put in place the reforms needed to rebuild a functional financial system? Can Congress do it? Everybody running like chickens with their head cut off, I suppose, for re-election right now. Is there the political will to do what's right?
Well, I guess my sense is that the country knows what needs to be done. That is why they elected Barack Obama in the first place. But there is a very widespread understanding out there of what the basic problems are and what a sensible approach would be to them. Communicating between the people and their political leaders is difficult, particularly when there are so many obstructionists and confusion artists in the way. And that's the problem that we need to focus on now.
Confusion artist. That's a good one. We know some of those who are. Last question. Might this moment in our history provide a new vantage point in the faith that has gone on since Reagan was president in unfettered free reign capitalism? How hopeful are you that this can give us a new perspective and we can become more stable and more secure for the long term?
You know, I think in many ways that's a settled question. The Bush administration led to the disaffection of many principled conservatives who understood that what they were seeing there was not what they believed in. And the Obama administration, if it does its job right, should be seen not as a government that changed our ideology, but simply as a group of men and women who took on the problems in a practical way and made some headway in dealing with them. And I think, you know, the American public is a very practical public. It will appreciate that approach if that's what the administration does.
So I'm getting the sense that you feel some degree of optimism.
A little bit more than 2 weeks ago, yes.
Well, that's great. Well, if people want to read more of what you've written, there was The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. Other things on the web you could point to, or other articles you'd like to suggest for people to read further about? John Maynard Keynes, for example?
Well, I'm a great fan of Robert Skidelsky's book on Keynes. But if you want to read Keynes, the thing to do is to pick him up and
read
him yourself. a wonderful volume called Essays in Persuasion, which discusses the problems of the 1930s as they emerged over the course of the Depression. Very vivid language.
Wow, Fascinating. Well, I hope we can learn the lessons that we really need to learn and don't get too distracted by the peacocks, the hawks, and the confusion artists. They're certainly running around. James Galbraith, author of 7 books, chair in the Government Business Relations Department at the Lyndon Baines Johnson, another good president, I have to say, except for Vietnam, of public affairs at the University of Texas in Austin. Thank you so much for being with us on The Burt Cohen Show, and perhaps we should get in touch in a year or so.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we'll talk about money here. And if you have comments or suggestions, don't forget to email me, Burt, B-U-R-T, at BurtCohen.com. Love to hear your input on the show, suggestions for new shows, Burt, B-U-R-T, at BurtCohen.com. Let's talk about money.